From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we start this hour with that blockbuster $26 billion settlement reached by state's attorneys general against three major drug distributors and one manufacturer of opioids. If approved by enough state and local governments, the settlement will resolve lawsuits against McKesson, Cardinal Health, AmerisourceBergen, and Johnson & Johnson. This follows a settlement earlier this month with Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, and it comes after a wave of opioid deaths, including last year alone, more than 93,000 dying from drug overdoses, most caused by opioids. Massachusetts Attorney General Moore Healey was the first state attorney general to sue the Sackler family, the family behind Purdue Pharma, and she helped broker this more recent settlement with four other companies. So, Attorney General Healey, what do you hope this settlement does?
I hope it's a message to other entities out there that you can't get rich off the suffering of our residents without consequence. It's about securing resources for our communities. It's about making major, significant industry changes to prevent this type of crisis from ever happening again. And it's about the kind of accountability that so many of our families have been seeking.
Yeah. Well, let me ask, drug distributors will collectively pay up to $21 billion over the next 18 years. Manufacturer Johnson & Johnson will pay $5 billion over 9 years. This is all, of course, once state and local governments approve the settlement. Just can you briefly remind us what they were accused of doing?
Well, basically, these are the companies that were either involved in making opioids like Johnson & Johnson or were in the distribution business. So they were out there distributing the pills around the country through pharmacies and the like. And so the reason this settlement is important is because it includes some really important terms that will change forever the way these distributors do business. Every pill is going to be tracked and accounted for. There's going to be really tight restraints on their processes for distribution. They have to implement really strong procedures around detecting and blocking and reporting suspicious controlled substances orders that show any signs of diversion. And so this is important in addition to the desperately needed funds.
In other words, one of the claims was they weren't keeping track. They were overlooking things like small towns where a drugstore might suddenly become the Amazon of online sales of OxyContin.
Exactly. And basically, the allegation against these companies is that they essentially turned a blind eye or in some cases participated in what really was deceptive sales and marketing practices and distribution that they knew that they had orders going into certain towns, certain pharmacies, certain counties that were way off the charts in terms of the actual number of residents there who legitimately needed opioids. So we call that diversion when pills are sent somewhere really to be used for abuse, for sale on the black market. And these companies had a responsibility about controlling their distribution channels. They knew that people were getting hurt. They knew the amount of pills that were being distributed just didn't match the need out there, and they were part of the problem.
West Virginia Attorney General Patrick Morrissey said he opposes this settlement because it allocates money by population and not by impact of the crisis. We mentioned how small towns and rural areas might have been completely devastated by maybe one drugstore or, has an epidemic swept through. Do you think he has a point?
I disagree with my colleague. It's never perfect when you do a multi-state resolution. Here, the money is allocated both by population as well as by harm, number of overdoses. If you look at the whole picture, we are now bringing back real money for our states and our communities, which is going to go to families. We are very clear, and I am very clear, that all money coming into the state of Massachusetts is only to go towards treatment and remediation and resources to address substance use disorder and to curb this opioid epidemic.
Yeah. One last question. This is about the settlement with the Sackler family, which you were the first to sue that family, the family behind OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma. You said you weren't happy with that deal because the Sacklers were able to use bankruptcy court to shut down state lawsuits against them. We also know that in this recent settlement, none of the companies admitted guilt in this. Is this over for you?
I mean, I think this fight continues. The recent settlement with the Purdue and Sackler family doesn't exclude criminal charges. Those can potentially still be brought. And what I've said is, look, I've asked the Department of Justice to consider that. I also went to Congress to ask them to change the bankruptcy law to close the loophole that allowed the Sacklers to go to bankruptcy court in the first place. So I think under existing law, we have made a significant change here and a significant difference, most importantly, in telling the whole story of what this family did, motivated by greed, without regard to the well-being of others, and what this company did, and the crisis that they helped start and then fuel. But I'm never going to stop fighting for families. I'm never going to stop fighting for more resources, for behavioral health, for substance use disorder. And I'm pleased that the settlements that I've been able to achieve, the resolutions, you know, will be a significant step towards that. But there are no victories in this case when you look at the context of the devastation and the harm. There is accountability. There is accountability. And I think that's what we were able to achieve. And that's our job as state AGs.
Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey, thank you.
You're welcome. Great to be with you.
A team of doctors has made a surprising discovery about what causes asthma attacks, and that discovery is largely thanks to the pandemic. Scientists started surveying Black and Latino people with the disease in 2018. They were hoping to learn more about why those groups suffered disproportionately from asthma. When COVID-19 emerged, doctors worried that death and ER visits due to asthma attacks might go up. Instead, they saw a steep drop-off. Now their finding is prompting a re-examination of what triggers severe asthma attacks and what we might do to prevent them from happening. Dr. Justin Salciccioli is a pulmonary and critical care fellow at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He's one of the co-authors of the study. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you.
So I want to sort of walk people through the why this is such a remarkable discovery. What did we think we knew about what caused asthma attacks before the pandemic?
Sure. So generally speaking, there are two broad categories of patients with asthma. Those who sort of have a more biological predisposition, and those who are somewhat more triggered by environmental things, so air pollution and common viruses and environmental toxins like perfumes, for instance. Overall, in the whole group of patients that we had, we saw about a 40% decrease in the rate of those asthma exacerbations after the arrival of the pandemic.
40% is huge. And what does this tell you? What questions do you now have about what causes asthma attacks? I know I am quite close to a couple asthma patients. Mm-hmm. I know at least in one case, every time there's an increase in asthma attacks for this person, the doctor starts asking questions about how they are preparing their home. Are they using the air filters they're supposed to use? Is mm-hmm. the patient taking the medication they're supposed to take? It seems to me like perhaps those were may have been the wrong questions to ask.
Well, we actually had the data to be able to separate these groups of patients. And the cohort of patients who are more prone to environmental triggers, we actually saw an even greater decrease in the rate of their exacerbations, somewhere in the line of between 50 and 60%, which is even greater than the overall cohort.
It's massive, just massive.
Truly
and yet
massive.
They were sitting at home.
That's part of it. I think that there were a number of things that changed in not only behaviors for these individuals, but you know, the population at large, where it may be sitting at home and it may be avoiding social interactions and large clusters of other individuals, and even mask wearing, which I think probably plays a significant role in this. And ultimately, this group of patients who are more prone to environmental triggers had a very dramatic decrease in their exacerbation rates. The other group of patients who had a tremendous decrease were the patients who reported to us at baseline, so at the time that they enrolled in the study, that they were working outside of the home, meaning commute to work. And that group of patients had a 65% decrease in their exacerbations, which is in keeping with this notion that these environmental triggers and common viruses probably play a role much greater than we previously thought.
And it could mean if asthma attacks perhaps are more often caused by a common cold virus than we thought before, it could mean that doctors ask asthma patients to continue wearing masks.
Right. I think that's going to be an interesting topic to broach. It's unfortunately become politicized, and we may be at the point where we start to recommend mask wearing and distancing for patients who are high risk for exacerbations from asthma.
That is Dr. Justin Salciccioli, a pulmonary and critical care fellow at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Thank you so much, doctor.
Thank you.
As COVID cases surge, the Biden administration is now reconsidering its plan to lift restrictions that have prevented hundreds of thousands of migrants seeking asylum from crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. And as we wait to learn what the administration decides on that, we want to understand what the process is like through the story of one migrant. Her name is Nancy. She and her two kids fled El Salvador and, in their quest for asylum, spent more than a year in a migrant camp. Washington Post reporter Aralise Hernandez has been following Nancy's journey and shared details with Here Now's Peter O'Dowd. Aralise began by describing the migrant camp where Nancy stayed in Matamoros, a Mexican border city across from Brownsville, Texas.
This camp sort of emerged as a result of a change in policy during the Trump administration with regards to asylum. And, you know, what started as a few tents turned into hundreds of tents that had been donated by aid groups. And when you first walk in, you can smell mesquite burning on earthen stoves, see children playing, and just tons and tons of people waiting to be let into the United States to make their cases for asylum.
And that's why you decide that it's a good idea to go there. And in fact, when you visit, you spend a good 2 hours in these camps before you decided to take a break, sit down on a tree stump, and that is when you inadvertently met Nancy. Tell us how that unfolded.
Yeah, I had been there for about 2 hours. It was my first trip. And at one point, I just, you know, got tired and sat down on this tree stump. And without realizing that, I was essentially in someone's living room. And it turned out to be Nancy's living room. And she sort of emerged from her tent and realizing my mistake, I asked her, you know, is it okay if I sit here? And we decided to stay in touch from that point on.
And what did she tell you about why she left El Salvador with her two children, Andrea and David?
Her husband was murdered years earlier in El Salvador as a result of some of the extortion and attacks that were happening on folks who were business owners. But it wasn't just his murder that had pushed her to flee El Salvador, but years later, as the family was fighting for, you know, local prosecutors to convict someone for this crime, they finally did. They reopened the case, and in 2018, someone was convicted, and that's when Nancy's problems became more acute because the gang members tried to kidnap her, Nancy's daughter, Andrea. David was being pestered on his way home from school. It got to the point where Nancy wasn't letting them leave the home at all. And in fact, the day after she left El Salvador, per her telling, neighbors sent her WhatsApp messages mentioning that the gang members had come to her house looking for her that very afternoon.
So she does make the journey north. She tries to get to the United States to make an asylum claim. And as you report, she, you know, she tells you that the process was prolonged far beyond what they ever could have imagined. But how does she get into the system in the first place? In other words, what was her contact with the federal government and how did she make this claim?
Individuals who crossed the river and at this point were surrendering to Border Patrol and claiming fear were being taken into custody, put into, you know, the Border Patrol stations, the hieleras, as they call them, these places that, you know, get really cold because the temperature's down.
Yeah.
Right. And they're processed into the system. But instead of being released into the country, which had happened in years prior, they were instead given a slip of paper with a notice to appear, which is like a court date, and then put on the bridge on Brownsville and told to walk across to Matamoros. This is not at all what she was expecting.
This was August of 2019?
Yes, this was August of 2019 at a time when, you know, President Trump himself was sort of dealing with a large influx of people, particularly from Central America, who were doing the same thing that Nancy was doing, although he tended to be of the opinion that asylum was just way too easy and most of these claims were illegitimate. Therefore, he wanted to make it much more difficult for people to go through this process.
And the reason I ask about the timeline is because it's important to point out how long Nancy and her family are living in this camp in Matamoros. November 2019, her first court hearing. And then she gets a second hearing scheduled for March of 2020. Now, tell me what happens at that point, because I understand she shows up for court, but the government's attorney is just a no-show. What's going on at that point?
This individual didn't show up for whatever reason. It's not clear to me what the actual reason was, but what was happening in the background is we as the United States are starting to get our first cases of the coronavirus, and it's starting to spread very, very quickly. So while Nancy was not aware that this was happening across the country, immediately after that is when the courts shut down for good. And they thought it wasn't real, that this was just another excuse that the U.S. government was using not to give them due process and a chance to make their claims. Remarkably, the camp itself did not record many cases of coronavirus, but nevertheless, it was the reason why they were kept out for as long as they were.
So that was March. I mean, she'd been in the camp, you know, by the time she finally got out, for like 18 months. That is a tremendous amount of time to live your life outdoors, first of all, and in limbo, not knowing what in the world is going to happen to you and your children. How did that weigh on her and her family?
It really brought her down. I could hear her deteriorating on the phone and in her emotional and mental health. It wasn't just the fact that they were living outdoors and they had suffered a hurricane. It was the persistent threat of violence and insecurity that surrounded them. This is an area that is absolutely dominated and controlled by criminal organizations who run the human trafficking, human smuggling, drug smuggling, you know, industry in that particular part of the border. And so, you know, there had been reports of children being raped, of women being assaulted. So all of this weighed on her tremendously, particularly out of concern for her children. Her daughter had turned 18 in the camp, and she was really scared for her.
Wow. So then February 27th of this year must have felt like a monumental day. That's when she gets to cross the border and finally get out of that camp. What happened? What was that like?
She still didn't want to believe it completely until she actually was across. But she called me that morning and had to undergo, you know, a COVID test. They would be placed on a bus and then, you know, cross over and sent into the shelter system of Catholic Charities for a little bit, processed, and then released to their various destinations. I met her the day after at a hotel that she was renting as she waited to buy her plane tickets.
To LA, right? To see her late husband's family or to reunite with them. What is life like in California now for Nancy and her kids?
All of it was just surreal, just pure unadulterated joy. But I did notice that for Nancy, it's still really difficult for her to be in the moment without her fears darting all over her.
I can imagine she's traumatized. And we have been speaking about Nancy, but what about her two children? You did not speak with them when they were living in the camp in Matamoros, but I understand you did once they got to LA. What did they tell you about their experience and what it was like for them to finally be freed of that burden of that limbo?
Well, they became different children once they were in the United States. They were much happier. I saw them smile for the first time. But their experience is one that they're loath to talk about. I'll let them explain.
Me siento feliz porque ya sufría mucho.
David is saying here that, you know, he's happy to be in Los Angeles. He's happy to be with his family. But, you know, he suffered a lot in the camp. And, you know, here he has an opportunity to study, which is something he didn't do. He lost 2 years of school while being in that camp, and that this is a different chapter of his life now.
And his sister?
Yeah, she has a different take.
Mi nombre es Andrea.
¿Cómo, cuán distinto fue el cumpleaños de este año comparado con la de ella?
I asked her in this clip what it was like to celebrate her birthday, which is the event that I went to, you know, with family, how different it is from her experience, because she had celebrated two birthdays while living in the camp in Matamoros. She said, well, it's here I'm surrounded by family. There I was all, you know, I had strangers all around me. It's a totally different experience.
Must have been just something to hear their voice after all this time to actually get a chance to speak with them. What was your takeaway after doing this reporting for so long?
Well, I think that for much of the duration of the Migrant Protection Protocols, which was the Remain in Mexico program, as is better known, for most Americans, I think they weren't aware that this was happening. And the fact that Nancy's story is a window into the costs and the real life consequences of a policy like this. My takeaway from it all is that, you know, we as a country probably need to take a moment to recognize what happened here and what the policy did to people.
What is the status of Nancy's case right now? What's next for her?
Her case is supposed to be transferred to an immigration court in California. Her next court date is October 2022. It speaks to, again, the backlog that exists in the immigration system. But all of that is tenuous. So she's still very much at a new beginning of a long process.
Aurelis Hernandez covers immigration and the southern border for The Washington Post. We're going to link you to her reporting from the new two-part podcast episode from Post Reports. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. We'll also link you at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Investigations into police use of force and misconduct were secret in California until now. We've sifted through hours of interrogation tape to find out who does the system of police accountability really serve and who does it protect. Listen now to every episode of the new podcast On Our Watch from NPR and KQED.
The Bootleg Fire in Southern Oregon has been burning for more than 2 weeks now. It is the largest wildfire in the country and has scorched almost 400,000 acres. It's 38% contained right now. This fire is so big and so hot, it is creating its own weather. And to explain how this happens, we're joined by Craig Clements, professor of meteorology and director of the Wildfire Interdisciplinary Research Center at San Jose State University. Craig, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, wildfires altering the weather. We're used to hearing that weather alters wildfires. How does it work the other way around?
Well, it's quite a complex process, but what happens is there's so much heat from these fires that they can create their own indrafts or winds that are bringing air into the fire for the combustion. And sometimes those winds can be really, really strong. And so that's one aspect of how these fires are creating their own weather. But another aspect is the updraft, which is where the smoke plume is going through the atmosphere and up into the higher altitudes of the atmosphere. That updraft becomes so strong, it creates its own cloud. And sometimes it's so deep in the atmosphere, we can create a thunderstorm from that updraft. And that's what we saw on the Bootleg Fire and some of the other fires in California, were fire-generated thunderstorms causing more lightning, potential rain, strong downdrafts or air rushing down to the surface. And so it makes conditions very erratic and dangerous for firefighters.
Can I sort of explain how this works and then you can correct me?
Mm-hmm.
So hot air rises, right? So
correct.
As it rises from the fire, it leaves behind a vacuum and other air rushes in to fill it, which propels that hot air even higher, which is creates these updrafts. And then when they get into the atmosphere, they can attract molecules to them that create those clouds. Is that sort of basically?
Well, no. What happens is you've got air rising.
Yeah.
And that air then cools and condenses.
There's
water vapor. And so what happens in a lot of these fires is that you're bringing air into the plume from mm-hmm. the ambient atmosphere. That brings in moisture. There's moisture generated from the combustion process as well. And that alone then creates the cloud.
Why isn't that rain good? Don't we want it to rain?
Yeah, but sometimes that rain, it's so dry in the western U.S., the atmosphere is very dry, and so what happens is that rain evaporates before it hits the ground. If these clouds are actually generating rain, and so that dry air, cooler air, rushes down to the surface, and what it can do is it can spread the fire in different directions.
I see.
So that's pretty dangerous.
And what about the lightning? Why does some of these conditions create lightning?
Well, because the cloud becomes what we call a pyrocumulonimbus, so it's a thunderstorm. It's so deep in the atmosphere, and just like any other thunderstorm that creates lightning and thunder, that's what we're seeing. And so we don't have a good understanding of the what we call cloud microphysics of pyrocumulonimbus because we haven't observed a lot of these processes before. It's difficult to obtain these observations. And so that's a current research agenda for a lot of researchers in the country.
And very sadly, with climate change, we may get more opportunities to study that, right?
Yeah, it is very interesting to see how many of these fires are really creating these pyrocumulonimbus clouds.
Craig Clements is a professor of meteorology and the director of the Wildfire Interdisciplinary Research Center at San Jose State University. Craig, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Cuba has been facing the biggest protests in decades. Thousands of Cubans taking to the streets starting July 11th, calling out worsening conditions and the authoritarian regime in the country. Hundreds have been arrested. In a country with a longstanding communist one-party system known for cracking down on dissent. So let's get a little bit of a primer with Professor Michael Bustamante, Assistant Professor of Latin American History at Florida International University. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And this, as I said, is a primer, will undoubtedly leave something out. But we know that since the revolution that brought Fidel Castro to power, mass protests are rare. How much significance do you attach to these?
I think they're hugely significant. You know, whether they lead to a tipping point or not is a different question. But even if they don't, nothing like this has happened in 60 years. The last time that anything remotely like this happened, you'd have to go back to the early 1990s, when in the throes of Cuba's post-Soviet crisis, there were isolated demonstrations in Havana. But what happened last week was all across the island. It didn't even start in Cuba's capital. And so it's simply unprecedented.
Yeah. And it seemed to be ground roots, just people seeing other people doing it and walking out their door. Why? We talk about worsening conditions. Remind us what they are.
You know, in a way, I think these protests are the result of a confluence of factors. On the one hand, Cuba is in the midst of its worst economic crisis in 30 years. Obviously, COVID has hit the country hard in an economic sense because the country is so reliant on tourism. Those economic grievances have fueled political grievances as well, a sense that the state is losing its claim to legitimacy among at least an important subset of the Cuban population. So all of these things, I think, are rolled into one in a way.
Well, let's skip back through history. And again, this is where we are really going to hopscotch through. But Cuba was a Spanish colony from the late 1400s until the late 1800s. Hundreds of thousands of slaves were brought in from Africa to work on sugar and coffee plantations. Cuba became a U.S. protectorate at the start of the 1900s. That meant the U.S. could intervene in Cuban affairs. So remind us how the U.S. did.
Cuba and the United States have long had sort of a love-hate relationship. You know, Cubans have long defined their sense of who they are in relationship to their point of view as to who the United States is, whether for good or ill, whether aspiring to match a U.S. model of modernity or rejecting U.S. impositions in Cuban affairs. Mm-hmm. But if we think about the context of the Spanish-American War, which is really the Cuban War for Independence, it gets misnamed, and I think that tells you everything. Mm-hmm. You know, it ends in real disappointment for those who have been fighting for Cuban independence with a U.S. military occupation that really no one wanted.
Yeah.
And that was followed by a number of other similar interventions, direct and less direct over the course of the early 20th century, which bred a real strong national strain in Cuban political culture that obviously carries through to the revolution in the 1950s and 60s.
People should Google Teddy Roosevelt and
exactly.
Dig deeper. But, you know, fast forward to 1933, Batista takes power in a military coup. Remind us why he was such an important figure.
Batista comes to power in the context of what was sort of Cuba's revolution before the revolution that we all know, right? The 1920s, there was a guy named Gerardo Machado who was in power. became a dictator. He was thrown out in a context of a revolution in 1933. And Batista kind of comes to the fore as really a reformist, a populist in some ways, but also an authoritarian. In the late 1930s, Batista established an alliance with Cuba's historic Communist Party, the same Communist Party that then would ally with Fidel Castro to overthrow Batista in the 1950s. So Cuba's history has lots of ups and downs and lots of, you know, unpredictable turns in that way.
Well, and when that happened in the 50s, Batista was backed by the U.S. So in essence, the Cubans were overthrowing the U.S. as well and installing Fidel Castro, the young revolutionary who led the Cuban Revolution, takes power in 1959. Just briefly, what were his ideas that inspired people?
This is one of the biggest sources of debate among Cubans and historians. You know, what did Fidel Castro think? What did he want? But suffice it to say, I think the evidence is pretty strong that during the course of the 1950s and into their, you know, 1959, 1960, Fidel Castro was not somebody who was openly embracing socialism. He was somebody whose ideas, whose nationalism, whose anti-imperialism, whose desire to have Cubans have more control over their destiny, and whose calls for, you know, clean government and elections were very consistent with lines of reformist and nationalist political thought throughout the early 20th century, right? But it's in those crucial years, 1959 to 1960, when the Cuban Revolution becomes a hotspot of the global Cold War. And suddenly there's also a strategic imperative for Fidel Castro to possibly align with the Soviet Union against a United States government that really is doing everything it can from very early on to sort of stop the revolution in its tracks, even a more moderate version of it.
Yeah, well, that brings us to 1961, the Bay of Pigs invasion, a failed attack by the CIA to push Fidel Castro from power. And then a year later, the Cuban Missile Crisis, this very frightening showdown between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. It was over Soviet nuclear-armed missiles in Cuba, just 90 miles from the U.S. It was resolved after several days, but this is a turning point in U.S.-Cuba relations. Michael, paint a picture for us of Cuba under Fidel Castro.
There's not just one Cuba under Fidel Castro. You know, Fidel Castro was the head of state of Cuba for a really long time, which is not to say there were some things that were not a constant, right? By 1961, you really have a state that's becoming a one-party state. You have an economy that's really governed by predominant state control. But, you know, the 1960s do not look like the 1970s and 80s, which is a time when the Soviet Union is really kind of backing Cuba and shaping the way that economics and politics work in the country to a degree that they weren't in the 1960s. The 1990s is this period of absolute crisis following the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, leading into the early 2000s, right, when in the wake of some of the reforms that the government had to implement during that crisis, they begin to pull back once their economic situation begins to improve. So, you know, Cuba has gone through different eras. There's different revolutions, despite the claims of the Cuban government that, you know, this process is simply one thing.
And I think we should just fast forward again to 2008. Fidel dies. His brother Raul takes over as president. A decade later, 2018, Communist Party stalwart Miguel Díaz-Canel becomes president. That ends decades of Castro family rule. What's his rule been like?
You know, suffice it to say, these have been historic years in Cuba. The quote-unquote historic generation that led the revolution, the Castro brothers, first and foremost, are gone. And this is, I think, is also part of the context out of which these protests emerge, because Miguel Díaz-Canel, as much as he is a party stalwart, you know, he's somebody who doesn't have the Castro name. He doesn't have the history behind him in a way. He's not a charismatic leader to the extent that charisma, you know, mattered to the Cuban revolutionary project before that point. So he has inherited a very difficult economic situation in the country, but he also faces really real political challenges at this time of generational transition.
Yeah. Well, we should touch on 2014 as well. Former President Barack Obama began normalizing relations, lifting restrictions. As an American, you could fly directly to Cuba, opening an embassy. Americans were flocking to Cuba. Then 2017, former President Trump put the travel restrictions back, took a harder line toward the country. And many of his supporters here in the United States are Cubans who fled Cuba when Fidel Castro came in, who approved of that. But there are others who want the U.S. to have closer relations with their home country. What are President Biden's options?
Before the protests last week, I think there were signs that the Biden administration was beginning to move towards starting to unwind some of the Trump measures with a similar theory of the case that the Obama administration had, which is one that I, you know, fundamentally agree with, which is that isolation, conflict, sanctions, these have done nothing to better the lives of the Cuban people. Now you have these protests. You have voices in South Florida that include, importantly, some of the portion of the Cuban American community that, you know, 5 years ago were really supportive of Obama's efforts, now have kind of taken a different point of view because they're so frustrated with the slow pace of change in Cuba. And in light of these protests, they are starting to argue to the Biden administration, now is the last time for you to unwind any of these sanctions. Sort of, we've got them on the ropes. That strikes me as a very limited way of thinking. I don't think we know if we're at a tipping point. And there's real humanitarian suffering that's happening that's being aggravated by U.S. policy, which is not to say that it's responsible for everything that is happening in Cuba today. So I hope the Biden administration can see through that fog and really, you know, put in place a policy agenda that's in U.S. interest and supports the Cuban people most directly.
Well, as I said, this is an outline, but a pretty good one of where we are today. Michael Bustamante, Assistant Professor of Latin American History at Florida International University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Olympic Games in Tokyo have begun, and there are a number of unique aspects to this year's Games, including a new grant that helps athletes care for their children while they compete. It's called the Power of She Fund Child Care Grant, and it's a partnership between athlete Allison Felix and the Women's Sports Foundation. The grant gives $200,000 to eligible athletes. Nine mothers have already received the grant, and it can help cover those child care costs, travel, and more. For more, we're joined now by Aaliyah Taylor. She's the Chief Marketing Officer at the Women's Sports Foundation. Thanks for joining us. This grant, it seems to me, could be monumental for an athlete hoping to get to the Games. Who's eligible for this?
So around the eligibility, it's really just female athletes who have one or more children under the age of 18, or female athletes who are expecting to welcome a child into their family in 2021. So it's really broad. We want to help as many women as possible. And the applicants need to be U.S. citizens or legal residents.
And we mentioned that nine mothers have already received the grant. What can you use this money for? What can an athlete spend?
You know, the expenses around motherhood, they can vary, right? So it could be everything from child care, you know, paying a child giver, you know, if they need some kind of service to watch their children while they're traveling. There was a decision made that nursing mothers could bring their children, which we're really excited about. And so, you know, those that are nursing are able to bring their children to Tokyo, but many will have to go to Tokyo alone while someone is back in the States watching their children. So it can be used for that. It can be used for formula, really used for any type of expense that a mother would have in raising her children.
So people may remember that Allison Felix, who's partnering with the Women's Sports Foundation on this grant, a track and field athlete, cut ties with Nike because she said in an op-ed for the New York Times in 2019 that they penalized her for being a mother. Can you tell me sort of about why this grant was created?
So the Women's Sports Foundation was founded in 1974 by Billie Jean King, who's really one of the biggest game changers of our time. And we have this history of being a voice and ally and advocate for girls and women in sports and working around issues of gender, equity, and equality. And we really take a holistic approach to supporting athletes. So starting the Child Care Fund with Athleta was another important step in how we could help athletes along their journey. We're really committed to helping mom athletes strive for peak performance in their careers while also balancing the challenges of motherhood. And so this grant was really inspired by Allison Felix and her story. She's a nine-time Olympic medalist in track and field and also mom to Cameron. And she takes both of those jobs very seriously. She's going off to Tokyo to compete in her fifth Olympics. And at, like many mothers, whether you're an athlete or, you know, you're working in business or you're a nurse or a teacher, no matter where you are, you want to know that you can do your job successfully while also keeping your family happy, safe, healthy. And so it's the same for all mom athletes. They have the same kinds of concerns. And we really felt like it was important to elevate this issue. And looking at Allison, again, we were really inspired by her using her platform. And more athletes are, and more women in general, are talking more openly about the realities of childcare and needing to address the challenges of balancing their family life with their career life. So we thought that this was a step we could take that would really help a lot of women.
We did get news from the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, that nursing mothers will be able to bring their infants to the Tokyo Games. Children were not allowed simply because of concerns over COVID. I wonder what other kinds of things do you think might be needed in the future to support mothers with kids who also want to compete?
You know, there are great organizations alongside the Women's Sports Foundation, like And Mother, which is an advocacy organization founded by athletes who are working on things in addition to giving grants like us. They're also working on programming like, you know, having nursing stations or, you know, places where, you know, athletes can change, you know, changing tables, things that seem pretty simple, but that we know that parents, even now, when they might go to a sports stadium or they may go, you know, even to an office, you know, how are those needs being met? How are they even given the time to, you know, step away, you know, or off the field, if you will, to be able to take care of their children and have those moments where they can interact with their family? So I think there's a number of things that the games could be thinking about in the future. And I think one of the most important aspects is actually talking to the athletes themselves. Right. It's something that the Women's Sports Foundation will be doing later this fall, along with Athleta and Allison, is to, you know, host some roundtables to talk with athletes and understand what are your needs. You know, instead of us trying to decide that for them, is really hearing from them and then developing additional tools and maybe helping to affect some, you know, public policy and sustainable change that will help these women in the future.
That's Aaliyah Taylor, Chief Marketing Officer at the Women's Sports Foundation. Aaliyah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.